Good evening. You're listening to KKRN 88.5 FM Community Radio out of Round Mountain. This is Jim Dowling, and I'll be your host tonight on another production of Scratched Up Radio Theater. Tonight we're introducing a new program. It's called Write Stuff. And on Write Stuff, we'll be hosting writers, mostly local. I plan to bring in local writers and have them read their material. So on this show, expect poetry, short stories, maybe somebody's working on a novel out there, and each reading will be followed by an interview. Okay, so tonight we have our very first guest. I'm really honored to have Catherine Gessner-Calkins here in the studio.
Hi there, Jim.
Great to have you here. I must confess, we know each other. We were part of a writing, a writing critique group put on hold because of the pandemic, but we have high hopes of gearing up again. So let me tell you a little bit about Catherine. She's a poet, a writer with recent publications in Louisiana literature, Big Muddy, Natural Bridge, the Squaw Valley Poetry Anthology, New Millennium Writings, Numinous, among others. She's also published a chapbook, which is a book of poems, called Scrub Jays and Lavender. She's also the author of an essay, Drawback Blood, published in New England Review, which was an AWP Intro Award Series winner. Catherine holds an MFA from the University of Arkansas Creative Writing Program and teaches writing and literature at our very own Shasta College here in Reading. So, Catherine, tell us a little bit about what you plan to share with us today.
Well, Jim, I'm working on a new piece, and so it's dangerous always to debut a new piece of writing on the radio, but here it is. I'm working on a new essay that just came up as a memory after an incident that happened this year after Black Lives Matter, and it just sort of surfaced, and I realized I had suppressed it, and that quality is apparent in the writing. So I'm just going to go ahead and read it.
Good deal. Oh, I can't wait. Okay, dig in.
Granite marks the way out. In early 1980, I stood up for a black kid at the bus stop. I sat on the bus already. The school year had just begun, and Zeb got on before me. Just us two and the driver Dot rolled on, taking the long, snaking route through the rural Pennsylvania countryside and eventually winding up at the high school. This morning, a new boy waited at the corner. We could all see him from some distance as we approached the stop, shivering there in his hoodie. "You ain't gonna let that black kid get on this bus, is you, Dot?" Zeb shouted from behind me on the bus. I froze. I could see Dot bristle. She didn't look up at us in her driver mirror, but her jaw was set. The morning tasted so stale I couldn't get my breath. Dot geared the bus to a stop. She flung the door open and hollered out at the kid. "Got a note? You can't get on the bus if you don't got a note." "No, ma'am, I don't have a note," the boy said, and he stepped backwards away from the bus like a viper bit him. Dot closed the door and drove off. I saw the back of the boy retreating up the hill as the bus sailed on. I felt my shame crawl down from my hot chest toward my itchy knees where it stayed. I didn't speak at all till I got off the bus. I went inside the high school and headed straight to the payphone in the lobby across from the library. My mother was a school board director. I called her. I told the story. "You're kidding me," she exclaimed. I backed my ear off the receiver. "No, Mom, I'm not kidding," I said. "I'm out of money for this phone." "I'll talk to you about this later," she said, and the line went dead. Trembling, I hung up the receiver and rushed to get to the bathroom before homeroom, fix my hair, look myself in the mirror to make sure I was still there. My mother reported over dinner. She had a long talk with Mr. Free, the superintendent. New pupils do have to clear their bus riding through parents in the district, and maybe there had been a miscommunication. Dot was unkind about it. The upshot was bus drivers went to student communication training, and our sociology classes added a required unit in race relations. My mother and I had never talked about racism. She was born and raised in the city, Philadelphia. That's where my grandmother worked, at the Franklin Institute cafeteria. And we were told one story, that if people wouldn't accept service from my grandmother's assistant manager, who was black, that my grandmother would throw them out of the cafeteria. If her hands aren't good enough for you, then my hands aren't either, she told them. When I called my mother that day, I knew what she would do. I had unleashed the force of justice, or so I thought. The story should have ended there. One afternoon, not long afterward, I was on the bus headed home. Dot was at the ship's helm. A senior boarded the bus and asked if it was all right if she got off a stop early because she had to go to work. Ask her, Dot pointed back at me. The girl was stunned. She looked at me, and I shrugged and nodded. She looked back at Dot, who said, fine with me then. After I got off the bus that afternoon, I heard that all the gossip really got started, and Dot told her version of events. I relayed what happened to my mother, and she said I didn't need to ride that bus anymore. She commuted to work with the across-the-street neighbor, and I drove her car to the high school. Problem solved, unless you were one of those guys on the bus that day listening to Dot's lament. I imagine they said, somebody ought whoop that girl. Her daddy don't whoop her. The next week after school, I drove the same route home I always did. The last 2 miles covered a backwoods dirt and gravel road. The dirt and gravel portion through the woods was sketchy and potholed. Coming up the back stretch, I spotted Nate Singer in his pickup in my rearview mirror. He drove right up to my bumper at high speed and tried to tap it with his grill. I gunned the station wagon, and it lurched into action. Holy shit, what the hell? Nate tried to cut around the bumper at high speed. I saw his anger, his determination. He was going to punish me, throw me off the road. I saw it and felt it, the harsh words. He was screaming something. Get off me, I screamed back. But it was all terribly loud, tires on gravel, engines, a deep metallic hammer gnawing into everywhere to say no. He yanked the wheel, sent me skittering into the leaves on the right side of the road. I yanked too, and he missed me. I missed granite boulders and oak trees and gunned the faltering four-cylinder even more. He cursed. I could almost hear him. But hard to hear him over the hard thrum of my heart, the tension, the sweat popping out of my veins. Still on the road and still here, there was a curve coming. I felt like I was peeing on the seat. I ran it hard into the curve, and he backed off. I hit the curve too fast for the wagon, and way too fast for the pickup. The top side of the curb lit up the wheels, and my car stretched to keep her tires in the dirt and gravel. I slammed the brakes there, let it fishtail, then drew a straight line in my mind and accelerated. No, 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 no! Then the tires caught the road and snap straightened everything to order. Damn, I steered through. Okay, I looked back at the pickup in my mirror, and he almost bit the bullet. For a second, part of the front of the truck was off the road into the trees with the bed skimming out, but he overcorrected and brought the rig back across, caught it before it did a 180, and straightened it out. I hit the second curve, near a clearing in a pond. I accelerated hard, opening some driving distance between the pickup and me. I was thinking if I could fly past the dogwood and forsythia through the last stand of trees, I could almost make it back to where people would help me if. I snagged a glance at the mirror again. Nope. He was coming on too fast. The V8 under his hood drummed into my ears above the ping of my troubled pistons. I pressed the pedal toward the floor, running toward a favorite cornfield if I needed a place to go. Yet the corn was a muddy patch of leftover stalks, and Nate was trying to pass me and swing me off the road again. I floored it, and nothing happened. A long hesitation, the truck pulling close, my breath aching silent in my throat. Then, for some reason, the Toyota kicked into high gear, jutted her nose out, and Nate was back behind my bumper. Not faster by much, and another curve coming, I would have to slow. The intersection with Boulder Road, people coming, a troubling sharp turn. I felt a twisting in my mind. I was so close to home and also in danger of being seen flying along like I was, with neighbors out walking, maybe about to be hit by me. Why? This guy. But I knew it. I knew why. He was one of them. He tried to ram the rear of the car as I swung into the curve. I braked anyway, and I saw the front of the pickup bear down as he braked too. I hit the gas and skirted free again, letting tires wheel their way straight onto the paved section. I got what he meant to do was get me off the road without much damage to his truck, and I guessed he didn't want to get caught either. I raced down the hill toward my driveway and hit the turn signal. The turn signal was my one act of defiance. I'm turning in, and if you want to hit me, go ahead. Everybody knew that my dad was retired and he waited for me to bring my mother's car home from school. He had a shotgun on the mantle and it was loaded. Everybody knew that too. Nate's mom, Patsy Singer, was a bank teller, and my dad told her all these things himself by way of making conversation. He didn't think there was any harm in it. The pickup sped by. I parked in the garage and checked over the car. I couldn't see anything unusual, no paint chipped, nothing. And I didn't really pee on the seat. I went inside. My father was busy digging in the backyard. I stood in the hum of the kitchen clock and waited for a minute to know what to do, what to say. I raced a kid home from school with my mother's car. He tried to hit me, that's why. Sure, he did. You did what? I played out the whole conversation in my mind and what would be said, coached myself. Right now, no one knows. I didn't think Nate would say anything. Wasn't anything to be proud of. He tried to shut me up and lost. A little feeling came over me that I had to suppress. I suppressed it hard. I would erase the whole memory and wouldn't even let myself know what was coming up. I threw up in the toilet and flushed. I dared to stand up. Part 2. It's 2021, and my son has been hit on the back roads of a rural town in Oregon by a Patriot militia dude driving a pickup, no less. As my son told me the story about the guy in the pickup driving too fast, running up on his bumper, and eventually trying an illegal pass and crashing into the front of his Honda Fit with the bed of the pickup, my blood ran cold. Guys out there have nothing to lose, and this concoction is deadly. Agitated guys in pickup trucks. The fear of the backcountry roads of a place gag up, the bile I've tried to swallow down my whole life, what people can do to mess a person up. My son is all right. And I'm listening to a podcast where Bruce Springsteen and Barack Obama talk about being outsiders. Bruce says he didn't make a difference in his hometown, not far from mine. He says Freehold is still the same. Oh, you made a difference, all right, I say right back at him. I'm sitting in my living room talking back to my speakers over lunch in between screen meetings. All these years later, I'm glad Bruce is speaking up, helping me to get a grip. Bruce sings My Hometown. I always thought the song was about getting the heck out of the village. I knew I didn't belong. I belonged to nowhere. I had Bruce for company on the radio. And now he says it's about taking responsibility for what happened. I'll try. I look at property records from my hometown, Upper Black Eddy, Pennsylvania. It is more of a rural swatch on a hillside than a town. The people who owned property back then still own it now. I can look at Dot's house on Google Earth, ranch style, painted wood siding. Granite stones are set on either side of the driveway. Outsiders have not bought or sold or moved into properties anywhere along any of these roads since I left. They all still live there. and my family has moved on. From the vantage of Google, I can see the junkyard that spanned the remotest backwoods acreage where vicious shepherds were chained to the chassis of wrecked cars and trucks. Human cruelty and bitterness grew up unchecked. Adults would even pit the children against one another. Oh, there is natural beauty. Yes, music and art, the festival, making hay in summer. Mosquitoes purpled our arms. The long red shale slabs of cool water kept on. Patsy Singer closed my bank account for me as I was leaving town to take a teaching job at a university. We chit-chatted about this achievement through the bulletproof glass at the local bank. I squinted at her through slanted eyes and noted I could fully thank my community for setting me on this path. She shrank back into her windowed box as I headed out. On my last visit to my hometown in springtime not long ago, I was sidelined by a passage through that same stretch of woods where dogwood grow out of the simmering swamp. The ditches on either side of the road teem with frogs. I pulled over to take a cell phone shot of a wild turkey hen and her brood crossing in front of me. No one swung around the dogleg too fast. All the poults survived. Survival is only the beginning.
Wow. Thank you, Catherine. Powerful story. Well, sounds like you come from another world. Tell us a little bit about Bucks County. I mean, things are fairly polarized all over the place these days, but it sounds like you grew up in that environment. Your parents were fairly progressive, and there were some people in town who really weren't.
I guess I didn't know that. You know, you only know the world where you are. And inside my home, although it seemed similar to the other homes, we were taught, you know, you look out for everyone and everyone has a chance. And so I didn't know that my neighbors felt differently until that incident on the back road. And I knew it, I guess, when the bus stop, when Dot spoke that way, and that just kind of it brought home that people really don't feel the way I did in my household. And again, if you're a kid, you didn't know that.
Exactly. Yeah. I can imagine. You know, you you're innocent. You're having a good time. Life is pretty simple, and then all of a sudden, an adult will say something that gives you a different insight into a complex world.
Yeah, I mean, my dad was complex himself. He wore two-tone corduroy, so he'd be brown on top and brown on the bottom. He wasn't like a fashion maven, except when he came home from his around-the-world flight. He was a pilot for Pan Am, and he could ask for beer in about 17 different languages. And so he was worldly and yet a hometown person. And he met my mother dancing in Philadelphia. And she, you know, she was an urban lady and she still is. She really likes to be part of a community, a city life. And those worlds blended perfectly for me and my household. We had a lot of fun growing up as a family. And I didn't really see the outside world clearly. And in fact, as I said, I suppressed this memory until this recent Black Lives Matter movement, where it brought to mind this whole series of events. And really, when I was listening to the podcast, which is what a lot of people did during the pandemic, sit and listen to a podcast, and I thought, oh, how good, how great. You know, Bruce Springsteen teaming up with Barack Obama. I was floored to hear Bruce say that he didn't feel like he made a difference in Freehold. I went to Freehold before I graduated from high school, I believe, to do store inventory for Sylvan Pool Supply Center, a swimming pool store. And I felt that Freehold, yeah, was desperately poor in the downtown. The shops had shut down like in the song, but I felt that it had changed. The environment had changed and become more progressive. But I don't think my hometown has changed at all.
Well, the turkeys are doing okay. Well, that's interesting. So you've been back a few times. You're seeing the same level of poverty and And underlying all that is a polarization. Some people are just not, like Black Lives Matter. They're resisting change, right?
Yeah, and I think it's a good point to bring up that the people haven't changed or moved or sold their properties. The idea of keeping things the way they are, it's really ground in. Just really different from, for example, your neighborhood in Old Shasta, yep, where you were talking about how much it's changed. Certainly the environmental disasters of a fire have changed it. But around here, there is a fluidity. People come and go.
Right.
And so
it's California.
You're always meeting new neighbors, sure, right?
Well, you know, it's like those quaint communities all over the place that aren't as fluid. We kind of look yearningly at them, but they're not always the most pleasant places to be, you know, culturally. So great story. A lot to reflect on. It certainly has a darkness to it. You know, when you think about, how these people will react in certain circumstances, you know. So what else do you have for us, Catherine? Can we hear maybe a poem or something? What do you have there?
Yeah, well, we just touched on the car fire. And, of course, there was the shock of several different fires in a row. So I have some fire poems, just a couple of fire poems to read to you. Begins here in Redding. These are local poems. Begins here in Redding in Minder Park. Which I think on the page is really nice, because it could also be Minder Park. Like, do you mind, or are you minding? Are you paying attention? And the other poem is called Order. And these poems were published by Louisiana Literature just this year. But, of course, the dates are of the poems, or the events in here are on the poem. So Order begins with a date. It's the Dispatch, November 8th, 2018, leaving Chico, California. So I think that's what started the writing of these fire poems. So this is two poems, one before the fire and one of me leaving Chico. Minder Park. Dust blows a devil toward the children who sneeze and whine with smoke lingering behind their eyes where the sirens wail. We know how to be safe here. Order. The V of the geese northwest seems to ignore the diagonal black stripe that hollows the canopy of my windshield, blots out the entire sky, counter to Cal Fire helicopters that fold into the black and disappear this morning. Paradise is on fire. I'm on I-5, heading south with the trucks and their straw bales splintering through the rice paddies. My headlights on, the sun is out. There is nothing to see in this blackness. Our headlights the only bright spot in this daylit night. I've got hot coffee and a news DJ to keep me company, and he says the fire is 1,000 acres. I know this cannot be true. As all the way to Highway 20 south, all things are unfolding from fire. Highway patrol cars with the ring of red flares, ambulances flying in the absence of freeway fatality. Losing nothing, gaining nothing, here beyond the rim of the paradise tragedy, the acceleration south to blue openness seems to catapult me away, 70 miles per hour, searching for the space where blackness can no longer reach us.
Whoa, you're bringing back memories, some not all that pleasant. Yeah, those were chaotic moments in my life, too. Great imagery there. You were spared the paradise experience just by luck, whimsy.
Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, I have survivor's guilt from being on the edge of all these fires where people I know who I've been close to, you know, lost everything. And somehow just by by luck, I did skim past that edge. And that, so you feel obligated to use your, I did, to use my skill in whatever way to tell the story.
Sure, sure.
To be able to write the story. You wrote a wonderful piece about the fire, too. And I yeah. really admired about that was that you focused on the renewal aspects.
Well, you know, funny thing you're bringing that up. I was thinking about that this morning. When I wrote my article about the fire, it was very therapeutic. And it was some instincts kicked in that I didn't know, wasn't aware of. It was like survival. Mm-hmm. I couldn't go into the defeat mode because I don't think I'd ever pull myself out. Mm-hmm. So it was all about rebuilding. It's got to be a bright future. It's got to be a new start. This fire took everything. And if you dwell on that, you're going down a deep, dark hole. So, yeah, thank you. That story was good for me. Good for me to write.
Yeah, and I mean, there was a group of people came up with a logo, you know, Shasta Strong. And for me in the car, there was this really eerie kind of stillness, like knowing something terrible was going on in paradise. And I even was super careful leaving Chico that morning to not, you know, take the usual routes. Like if to go to Santa Rosa, you might from downtown Chico hop onto, you know, an evacuation route. I was super careful to avoid that. So once I got out to I-5, I just felt terrible. Something terrible is happening. You know, I had to clean 3 inches of ash off my car. So the writing, actually initial first draft, was dictated into my cell phone because felt like I had to speak it. Like, say something. I was alone in the car and had just survived the fire that I was on the edge of, you know?
That's pretty spontaneous.
Yeah.
Well, hey, we don't have a whole lot of time left. I'm going to throw out this question because we have listeners out there that probably don't write a lot. And this is a loaded question, but where do your stories come from? Where does poetry come from?
You know, poetry is a natural mystery. It comes from, you know, a kind of song in your head, a kind of rhythm of the line in your head, the language in your head. And so each person writes a different line length, and each poet and each poem demands a different set of skills.
Sure.
So I think sometimes poems seem to tell you what you're thinking when they appear on the page. So for a poet, we don't, I've heard fiction writers say they plot things out and they've got their characters and they imagine what's going on with them. I'm just listening for that tune in my head. Hmm. And I think there's a similar take with songwriters who are listening for syllables, sounds that work with the music. And I'm just listening to the language.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
How does the sentence come, and where's the breath pause? And
yeah. Okay, well, thank you very much for coming in. I'm really honored to have you, Catherine, as my first guest on this new show. I'm sure there are glitches, but not enough to call it a comedy.
Thanks for having me here, Jim, and it's great to launch this.
You're great. You're relaxed, and I'm shooting for that myself, so... I'm going to make a couple of announcements here, and we'll wrap it up. Okay, so with the time remaining, I wanted to mention a few changes coming to Scratched Up Radio Theater on Thursday nights on KKRN at 8 o'clock. The first Thursday of each month, Scratched Up Radio will repeat the previous month's radio play. The second Thursday of each month, it'll be a new program called Arts Around Town, hosted by Linda Reagan. She's going to talk to people in the theater arts area, probably Riverfront people, maybe Axiom, and you know, we're talking interviews and what's going on. It's going to be a good show. The third Thursday of each month is our new play of the month, whatever we are producing that month. That's what we've been doing all along. No big change there. And the fourth Thursday of each month is Write Stuff, what you just heard tonight. So thank you for listening. I hope you have a great evening, and we'll just sign off with good night.